All right, well, we are back once again for Morgoths and Devas. Let's just check to see if that's working there. We are back once again for Morgoths and Devas. Classic movies, number 14. We've made it to number 14 now on these. Here we go. There's my man in the chat giving me the heads up. We're all off. I mean, I will say, before we get into the stream itself, you know, I really like the classic movies. I go far and wide around on the internet, and I always feel like when I'm back on my channel doing the classic movies streams, it's the most cozy, and I know that it's like the core audience are here for this one, because some videos get a lot of traction. And, you know, it's all strangers in the comments and stuff. And I like this one because, you know, it's like the, you know, it's the hardcore, you know, it's the people who really like your stuff on the classic movies. So it's nice to be back. It's a happy new year, everybody. I'm getting off to a nice, pleasant start. And someone says on time, we're like, yeah, well, I tell you why. It's because I've got no faith in technology. And the little bit at the beginning is I always find it really awkward in case it doesn't go right. But we are here and Endeavor is back with us. How are you, Endeavor?
I'm doing great. I'm glad to be back for another one of these streams. They're always really enjoyable.
So today, what I wanted, if you're as big a Clint Eastwood fan as I am, in the Clint Eastwood canon, I mean, I think this is like this will be the second and third time we've covered Eastwood. We did Dirty Harry. Was there any others? No, we haven't touched Dollars yet, have we? The Dollar trilogy.
We haven't gotten to that one yet.
But in the general canon of Clint Eastwood's westerns, there's always two which kind of stuck with me because they had a kind of supernatural, weird, mythical kind of thing to them, which I never really got. You always felt as if there was more to uncover with them. And that's High Plains Drifter and Pale Rider, which we're going to have a chat about today. And the reason why, really, is because you don't actually know if Clint Eastwood's a real person or not. You don't know if he's a ghost or anything like that. Did you get the kind of the supernatural vibes from these movies, Endeavor?
Yeah, I definitely thought that in the movies he wasn't a regular man. He seemed like he was some kind of spirit in both of them. There's a way you can interpret that maybe he's the same spirit in both of the films, although the spirit is completely different in the two films. It is really interesting to contrast it. But I do kind of find that, especially in Pale Rider, the kind of the mystic element is really interesting. It's fascinating in a Western because it's not really a genre that you see it very often.
So I was going to, this started because I was going to do an actual like scripted video essay on Pale Rider. So I've got quite a lot of stuff written down about it. If I don't completely pillage all of me hot takes in this, I may well do the video one day. So I thought I'll jump in with this. So this is what I had scripted down. We'll begin with High Plains. In High Plains, Drifter Eastwood arrives in a shabby dump of a town in the middle of the scrub called Largo. Eastwood is in the town for less than 10 minutes when three goons pick a fight with him and he shoots all three dead with ease. He then proceeds to drag a mouthy woman into a bar and rape her in broad daylight. And it's here that things begin to get weird, because despite that, the local townsfolk seem fine that somebody arrived in town and shot three men. In fact, they begin to see Eastwood as a potential leader or even savior figure. The story is actually quite deceptive and complicated, and I'll run through it here just quickly. The three goons Eastwood shoots at the start were themselves hired by the townsfolk to protect them from another three goons who were about to get out of jail. And they're angry because the not-so-good folk of Largo, because they were themselves hired to murder their sheriff after he discovered the illegal mining operation that the local businessmen were engaged in. The townspeople then framed the three goons for a robbery they didn't do. And so basically, the people of Largo are lying, thieving, backstabbing, cowardly scum. But more than anything, they're cowardly. So that's kind of the gist of High Plains Drifter. Like, what do you make of the townsfolk of High Plains Drifter, Andela?
Well, I'll let you take the John Wayne take on it, but I definitely see that, you know, they weren't very they weren't very likable people. I mean, they're rude, they're aggressive, and you know, they don't seem to care about someone coming into their town and like shooting people and raping women and things like that. And then they're also just incompetent as well. There's the scene where Eastwood is trying to train them to fight off the three bandits who are going to return, and they're just missing. They can't hit the broadside of a barn, and it's really quite comical. I mean, you know, I don't think that they would be very reflective of people in the Old West, but I think that for the story, if it is a story about kind of the town, like retribution being brought upon Largo, being brought upon the town, it couldn't have happened to a nicer group of people.
Yeah, I mean, and then what happens is then you get, that's the initial kind of kickoff. The pitch is that they've framed, they got three people to kill the sheriff, and then they framed the three bandits, and then they framed the three bandits because they got the three bandits to kill the original sheriff, the mysterious sheriff. And then they frame the three bandits to get rid of them. But now the three bandits are coming out of jail, so they've hired another three bandits to kill the original three goons. But Eastwood's come into town and killed the goons who were supposed to kill the bandits. And this means that now they want him to take care of the original bandits. And the takeaway from all of this is that they hand him the town. They allow Clint Eastwood, because he doesn't have a name in it, mystery man who came out of the scrub, then they allow him to do anything he wants. Like, they're so spineless and so craven. It's like, you can have anything in the town. I mean, if you want to rape a woman in broad daylight, that's no problem. Have all the cigars and all the whiskey. Just don't let these bandits, like, hurt us. It's absolutely pathetic. And then he tries to train them up into a kind of like a standing army, and they're completely and utterly useless. And where all of this leads is where in the end he gets them to paint their own town red. And he, where it says on the sign at the outside of it, Largo, he paints over it hell. And there's a lot in that, because they are like, they are scum, except for a couple of people who he kind of, I mean, the midget in particular, and then there's a woman who's quite like, sort of, she's got a good heart, the woman who runs the hotel with her husband, who's also a scumbag. And so he makes the midget the mayor of the town and the sheriff of the town, and just generally like lords over at them, like a kind of feudal king or something like that.
Yeah, what's really interesting about the dynamic of so Eastwood being made the like the absolute dictator of this small town in the Midwest, and him making the midget, he makes the midget both the sheriff and the mayor of the town. And I really found the midget's character really interesting, because in the first few scenes, he's like he works at the barber shop, I think, and he like is an aide to the barber. So he's a really low status person in the town, and then people just kind of push him around and stuff. And Eastwood makes him the sheriff and the mayor, so he goes from being the loser of the town, being the lowest status guy there is, to being the second highest status person in the entire town, next to the stranger, the Eastwood's character. And I also thought that it was very reminiscent of the concept of bio-Leninism. So this was originally theorized by a blogger named Spandrel. He wrote very, very well-written blog entries about what he calls bio-Leninism, which is basically like intersectionality, or cultural Marxism, as you might call it. put into practice. So the way that in the West today, you'll see all these like the people you call the skintellectuals, the you know, the racial activists, the ugly feminists, the transgenders, and all these people being given positions of authority, being artificially their status is being artificially raised. And the reason that they do that is that it makes them a lot more loyal to the power structure of Globo Homo. So today, if they'll always try to get one in any corporation, they'll always try to get, you know, some like fat black lesbian or something up into the HR department. And what that's going to do is she's going to be completely loyal to advancing the ideology of Globo Homo, because and in turn get this corporation on board, because without this kind of power structure, she'd be someone who was completely low status and would have no power whatsoever. So she becomes like the most loyal person to this cause. And so originally Leninism, what Spandrel used in his blog was, he talked about how Lenin used this after the Russian Revolution, making to make people loyal to the Russian Revolution. He made a certain ethno-religious group, he put them in power. He put other ethnic minorities and like weird sexual degenerates, feminists and stuff like that. Anyone who was hostile to traditional Russian society was put into a position of power. And anybody who was loyal to Russian aristocrat or any like high status man was removed from power. And that essentially creates this perfect power structure. And you see that playing out in Lago, because the midget is the most faithful companion of Eastwood in the entire movie. So as the entire town is getting fed up, they realize that this is an absolute disaster. The midget is he's the one who keeps who stays loyal, because he knows that his status, the second that this power dynamic is gone, he is probably going to be on the outs. Like the innkeeper is probably going to shoot him the second that the stranger leaves town. He's probably going to get shot. So he becomes the most loyal enforcer of the new power dynamic, which is really interesting, because we're seeing that today.
And it's a way for Eastwood to degrade and humiliate the townspeople like even more than what he already does, because then they like the lowest source, the lowest standing person, like literally, is made their boss. And like the point, they still put up with it though. They still go along with it because they're so terrified of these bandits who are gonna, they're on their way, they're out of jail. In that way, it's like a much darker version of High Noon. Where so in High Noon, it's John Wayne didn't like that, and he hated High Plains Drifter. But because he said it wasn't like that. He said the Old West wasn't as cynical, the people weren't cowardly. I think he had a good point. And we'll get back to this later with Pale Rider. But I actually think John Wayne was right. I think when you have something which is nihilistic as High Plains Drifter, in terms of the way it looks at the American kind of the mythos of the Old West and the way that Americans think about themselves, John Wayne wasn't really a liberal at all. You know, he was saying we need to have positive depictions of the Old West because this is our identity. And you can see that what's being done in High Plains is like a deliberate kind of snub to that. And so in more ways than ones, it's even attacking the myth, because at least in High Noon, it was a kind of nuanced study of how the normies are cowardly and they just want to sort of, you know, they just want to get by. And they in that one, there's bandits on the way to the town. They're going to arrive on the train and Gary Cooper has to stand there and he runs around asking for help. And nobody wants to help him at all. And so High Plains Drifter kind of takes that one step further, where the vast majority of the people in the town, it's not just that they're meek and they're scared of standing up for themselves. It's that they're like lying, thieving, conniving little shits. And so you enter this kind of thing where you think, like, what Clint Eastwood's doing to them is pretty bad. But there's a part of you which thinks, like, do they not deserve it? Do they not? Is this not? Is this like divine retribution? I remember Rob Eager had a take on High Plains Drifter some years ago. And he pointed out, because he notices these little things, and what he was pointed out is that the people who get punished and the way they get punished in High Plains Drifter is always reflected of something that they have done in the past. So the woman who Clint Eastwood rapes at the start of the movie, I mean, this, you know, just imagine that today. And it's done in a way where, like, once he's actually, and I've got to be, you know, to put it delicately, once he's actually like in the saddle, once he's full flow, she seems to enjoy it and just give in. So it's so dodgy in that regard. But she uses her sex, her attractiveness, to manipulate the men. That's her way of surviving and getting power in Largo. And so eventually, like, her being raped is like sort of it's like her comeuppance, you know. And it goes for the same. It goes for the same for the other people who get killed as well. So it's you end up where you're thinking, do they deserve this kind of humiliation that they're getting? Do the normies? I mean, this is what I was going to touch on in the script of a video. Do the normies deserve everything that they're going to get if they're not going to stand up for themselves? It kind of relates to the last video I did on my channel, which got a lot of pushback.
Yeah, you know, it's a difficult question to answer, because you do wonder, like, how is it possible that there are these, you know, people who are otherwise competent, people who would be high status in these corporations? You know, let's say, like, you know, a competent straight white man who is able to build his own business or whatever, but he gets this job in this Fortune 500 company, and he's sitting there like listening to some, you know, graduate from gender studies, something like that, like 25 year old just out of university, lecturing him about like privilege and oppression and stuff like that, you know, the bio-Leninism. I do wonder, like, is it worth it? You know, for me personally, it isn't. Like, for me, I wouldn't put up with that stuff. If you offered me a $10 million a year salary, for me personally, my honor is more valuable than that. But then, you know, you see, like, that so many people today are just willing to go along with just the worst of humiliations, just to kind of keep that, just to get a small leg up, just to get just ahead, you know, just to get that promotion. You want to, I'm not going to use any crude analogies, but just to get that new promotion, they're willing to just get down on their knees and do almost anything. And it really is quite humiliating. It says a lot about honor, and you do wonder, do people deserve it? I think, at least in my opinion, you know, if you never actually stand up for yourself, then you can't really expect anything else.
I mean, Alan Bastard says in the chat that Eastwood is the ghost of the sheriff. So I was actually like leading on to that. So what happens in the flashback? There's a big standoff at the end, and we discover that the townspeople set their own sheriff up to be murdered, and it's typically for this movie. It really does, like, this whole movie leaves just a bad taste in my mouth. If you go back through Eastwood's canon, there's quite a few dodgy bits here and there. And this is probably his most unpleasant movie, like, it has to be said. And then when he's the sheriff, he gets, like, whipped to death in the street. And he's calling out for the townspeople to, like, help him. Because there's like 20 of them, and there's only three goons, but they just stand there. And in fact, they've like set them up. They want this to happen. And the reason that they want it to happen is because their town, the local businessmen have all invested in a mine, and the mine is actually on government property. So that's the problem. That's Largo is actually, the wealth of Largo isn't legitimate. And so from me blog post, I actually said the cruelest trick Eastwood pulls is to get them all excited for the arrival of the three killers. They think, of course, he'll do all the fighting for them. But when the bell rings to signal their arrival, he simply rides out of town, leaving them to face their own cowardice and hypocrisy, and in many cases, deaths. there's at least 20 people living in Largo, yet they're all terrified of just one or a few gunslingers, despite the fact they all have guns. It's a perfect depiction of how an unruly mob can be dominated by fear and violence. Numerical superiority means nothing when it goes up against men who will kill because nobody wants to be the first to take the risk. The people of Largo ended up living in hell because they outsourced their safety to tyrants and they were willing to undergo every humiliation and emasculation. In many ways, High Plains is a spiritual sequel to High Noon. Another, that's where I got into what I was saying before, where so you can see why John Wayne like absolutely despised this and that it was a deconstruction of the Western myth.
And you can also see that even play out today. I think that you've made this point on Telegram a few times that you'll see these protests, and we don't need to get into the issue that they're protesting, but you'll see these protests in cities like Melbourne or London or Paris or pretty much anywhere in the world at this point. And they'll have like tens of thousands and maybe even hundreds of thousands of people who are, you know, clearly pissed off about the way that things are going. But, you know, one thing that I also thought, though, is, you know, are these protests actually going anywhere? Now, that's debatable. Who knows? We are kind of seeing a change in the tide. At least there's there's some glimmers of it. But I also thought, though, will these people actually be willing to endure some kind of hardship to actually get what they want, to actually get rid of this tyrant, this tyranny that they're protesting over? And I am afraid that I feel like a lot of them won't. So when people come out and march on the streets, and I'm not trying to denounce anyone for doing that. I do think it's good that you do it. But if you still end up doing what the tyrant tells you to do, despite all that, then I think that you're not going to actually be able to overthrow that tyranny anytime. You will have to actually at some point bite the bullet and actually endure some kind of hardship. You're going to actually have to pay a price eventually to actually make a difference. And what you see High Plains Drifter. Sorry, I was getting the titles mixed up. What you see in High Plains Drifter is that the people in the town, they're just not willing to bite the bullet at all. Like nobody is willing to take a stand anywhere. And they just keep descending further and further into hell because nobody is willing to take any stand anywhere.
I mean, I think it's interesting as well because in like, say, Western culture, we all identify with Clint Eastwood. So when you're watching a movie like this, I mean, I suppose it'll be different for a woman. But as a man, when you're watching a movie like this, we're kind of trained to identify with Clint Eastwood. And in actual fact, like nobody wants to identify. So you've got like violence coming to the town in the Old West. And everybody wants to be, everybody like puts themselves in the shoe of a gunslinger who's going to stand there and, you know, like stand up and fight. Nobody puts themselves in the apron of the bartender who's hiding behind the bar or the man who jumps on his horse and leaves town to avoid it all. But in actual fact, like that's most people. Most people are like that. I mean, we are, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, you can just see that with a lot of people today that I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to. And again, I don't need to get into this particular issue, but the one thing that the regime has spent the last year trying to get people to do, you know, applying the most relentless of coercion we've ever seen to get them to do it. Anything, you know, short of like putting a gun to your head. I've spoken to a lot of people who said, oh, I don't want to do it. I'm not going to do it. But then, you know, when push comes to shove, they do it. You know, I can't tell you how many people I've spoken to who agree with me on almost everything on this given issue, but then they've still given in because it just got mildly difficult. And we also have to put difficult, you know, from a modern perspective, because, you know, if you look at any other time in history, you can even look at, say, the Old West, for example. You know, people weren't living this kind of life of overabundance that we are today. They had to endure a lot more. And, you know, some of the pressure that's being put on people today, that which is getting them to fold to certain agendas, it really is quite incredible when you consider how all of this stuff that they're giving in to tyranny in exchange for is stuff that even their grandparents like wouldn't even have had. So like people in the old West, or hell, not even the old West, just like people 100 years ago, they never would have had any of this stuff. And it's something that we've just taken for granted so much so that we're willing to endure just the most pathetic of humiliations and the most egregious overreach just so that we don't just take it on the chin and endure a small amount of hardship.
I mean, at the end of it as well. So pretty much half the town gets shot and killed. I think the good woman who, I mean, Clint Eastwood beds her as well. Like he isn't like a guardian angel at all. And then half the town are dead. Everything's completely wrecked at the end. Half of it's burned down. It's painted red and called hell. And then he, the midget standing next to his gravestone, you know, it's got his name on, and I forgot what he says. It's something like he's Sheriff Duncan or something. And basically, Clint Eastwood like makes a little quip as if to say, "You know who's under there." And then he goes off into the what would you call it? Like the haze, like the heat mirage thing of the desert. And then, I mean, so then it brings us really to. It's a really stark contrast, the color scheme and everything. And this is, so my hot take, what I was leading to here, because we'll go on to Pale Rider. What I was leading to is that Pale Rider and High Plains Drifter are almost like the opposites. It's almost like heaven and hell, or good and evil, or something like that, or like black and white. It's and then when you see the color scheme of Pale Rider, it's very gray and very white. I mean, I love the scenery in Pale Rider of the mountains and the forests and all of this. It's absolutely gorgeous to look at. It's much easier on the eyes and the senses than High Plains Drifter. But this time around, so Eastwood arrives in town, and this time around, you've got a corrupt sort of oligarch businessman who's running a mining operation again. And this is what I'm saying, that there's so much overlap the way the two films like meld together. And so he arrives, and this time the Lahud, he's called, wants all of the kind of panhandling kind of tramps who live in shacks and tents and wooden huts. He wants them all cleared off so that he can have all of the land and the creek and everything. So this is where the tension comes in, and Eastwood comes in to help them. But this time, it's a stark difference. This time, Eastwood, he arrives as a priest, and he's a lot more, he's a more mature, but he's also a more kind-hearted man as well. And another huge difference is that this time the townspeople, they're not scumbags like they are in High Plains Drifter. They're actually good. They're good people, but they're meek. And I think it's much more biblical, Pale Rider.
Yeah, there was actually one other point I had on High Plains Drifter. Would you like me to get that in, or should we
check? Yeah, go on to the next one. Go for it. There's no structure.
So what I thought about is there's this concept in business called the sunken cost fallacy. And it's a theory that you shouldn't consider past costs which are not recoupable. It's called sunk costs. You should only consider future benefits when making a decision. And this can apply to business, to war, to almost anything really. And like the classic example is that if you were walking to the store, which was 10 minutes away, and 5 minutes down the road, you realize, oh, wait, the store is actually closed. You're not going to walk all the way to the store and then walk back. You're just going to walk back home, because if you've wasted 5 minutes, you can't get those 5 minutes back. You'll spend another five getting home. You've lost 10 minutes, and that's that. But if you continued walking knowing the store was closed and then came back, you've lost 20 minutes. So this can apply to a business. So for example, if you're someone who has spent, say, $10,000 starting your own business, and your business is just losing money, but rather than just cut your losses, you continue investing money to try to recoup the money you've lost, you're just going to get yourself further and further in debt. You're just digging a deeper and deeper hole. You could also think of like a war, like a country, like 100,000 men die in the war, and they want to keep fighting because they don't want that 100,000 to have died in vain. But then they lose another 100,000 after the war is already unwinnable. I thought of this with the deal that they made, that the town made in High Plains Drifter, where their entire situation is just the result of the sunken cost fallacy. They aren't able to actually just bite the bullet and cut their losses anywhere. It started with the with them, you know, breaking the law and with the illegal mine. Then they killed. Then instead of actually like owning up to that, they killed their sheriff. And then the other thing I did notice in High Plains Drifter was, because it was the first time I had seen the film, when I thought when Eastwood had the dream of the sheriff being whipped to death, I thought they were the same person. But I noticed that he didn't have a beard in the dream, but then as the stranger, he did have a beard. And the first thing he did when he entered the town, all he wanted to do was just have a shave and then leave the town, a shave and a bath. But then the three goons interrupted his shave, so he had the beard for the entire time, which I thought was really interesting. But
that is an interesting touch, actually. I mean, it's as if that's one of the classic scenes where he's lying in the bath and the woman that he raped comes in and tries to shoot him. We've kind of glossed over a lot of neat little touches. Yeah. He's in the barber's chair and the goons come in at the door to shoot him. And then he kind of spins himself around and just shoots them all, like with the gun under a blanket thing that he's got on, a cover. The thing with the beard, it's so when he's getting whipped to death and he's the marshal, he's the local sheriff, then he doesn't have a beard. And I think it's because that's Clint Eastwood as a normie. One of the things you'll notice about Clint Eastwood's movies, it does this in Outlaw Josie Wales, is that when Eastwood's like a normal man, like normie, average guy, he doesn't have a beard. But when he's going to go rogue and he's going to go hardcore and become Chad Clint, then the beard comes. And it's funny that he was trying to become a normie again, but they wouldn't let him because there's too many scumbags want to kill him. So he like the beard's on for the rest of the movie. It's interesting that, yeah.
The other thing to point out is that the three bandits were actually not even going to return to the town, I believe, unless I can't remember correctly. But he actually went there. He actually found them and then shot at them from behind a cover to make them think that the people of Lago are trying to kill them. I think that he actually convinced them to come back to Lago. I think that they were just going to leave and then not even return to the town at all. So even hiring the other three goons was pointless. But what you see with the town is that they keep making worse decisions based on prior bad decisions and to recoup for their sunk costs. So now that they've killed the sheriff, well, now they need some guys to, now they need to frame the bad guys. Now they need to hire other bad guys. Now that those bad guys are gone, they need to hire Eastwood. And now they're dealing with like the humiliation from the midget and their business is being destroyed and stuff. It's all self-inflicted from their unwillingness to actually just admit to what they were doing was wrong and then just cut their losses. And I think you see this a lot today with politics and with certain agendas that are pushed. You know, I think about something like Agenda 2030, which we're allowed to use that on YouTube, correct? I don't think that's banned yet.
Not yet.
Okay, so just imagine like the amount of money that the elites have put into this. What was the actual dollar number that they were talking about at the COP26 convention or something?
I think they've got like $140 trillion invested in it or something.
Yeah, and like I didn't even know that amount of money existed on the planet.
I think it's about 40% of all of the wealth in the world.
Yeah, it's incredible. But what's terrifying about that is that I think that when this thing doesn't go well, and I think it won't, I just think it's not based on reality. That's going to be the mother of all sunk cost fallacies. These people are going to go to hell and back to not to recoup those losses. So they're going to be like, I shudder to imagine how far they're going to push this Agenda 2030 stuff. If, down the line, it looks like it's not working out so well for them. You know, it gets quite scary. And you get back to the town where they've now painted their entire town red. It's on fire. They're taking instructions from some midget and they're all being shot. All of that is based on just recouping their the loss when all they should have done was just not broken that one law to begin with.
Yeah, and it's like the original. So the original sin, really, of the town. You could say it was the main, that they shouldn't have had the main on the government property. But I think really the original sin of the town is that they murdered their own sheriff, who was an honest man. And then all of them, so it corrupted everybody. So not everybody in the town was in on it, but they knew and didn't do anything. They kept their mouths shut. So you've got three or four people of the local businessmen who arranged the conspiracy to have their own sheriff murdered. But then all of the bystanders, that the prostitute and the midget and everybody else, they know that this happened in the town. And the midget is one, like, he feels bad about it, and so too does the woman who owns co-runs the hotel. And Clint Eastwood has sex with her, of course, as well, just because it's Clint Eastwood. But then she eventually leaves town, and the midget is sort of, so that there's not much in the way of catharsis on High Plains, but that's it, that the people who had good hearts throughout the whole sorry mess of it, they survive at the end, and they move on. Whereas the town is just a complete wreck, a complete ruin, and all of everybody's dead. Half of them are dead. They've been humiliated before that. It's a sad thing.
So with Pale Rider, you could see how Eastwood could have written the exact same story, because there is kind of the same aspect of, like, the murdered man coming back from the dead to set all the wrongs right, and then there's also the aspect of greed and the mining operation. Though I don't know if it was actually, like, illegal in Pale Rider, but what kind of does make it a lot more uplifting of a film, a lot more happy of a film, is that, you know, the spirit who comes back doesn't only come back to enact vengeance upon the wicked, but also to bring fortune to the virtuous.
Yes. Yeah, that goes right at the heart of it. I came across one. I looked at it all. I did a little bit of research, especially on Pale Rider. And there's quite a lot of biblical themes, so much so we should have probably got somebody who's more clued up, you know, like Lambda or Distributors or somebody on to sort of give us, because there's, especially with the kind of Protestantism in America, which I don't really know much about, and there's people in our circles, we should probably get, like, specialists on when we're going to hit certain themes. But whatever, I mean, just on the Wikipedia page, it says the movie's title is taken from the Book of Revelation, chapter 6, verse 8. And I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and his name that sat on him was Death, and hell followed with him. The reading of the biblical passage describing this character is neatly choreographed to correspond with the sudden appearance of the preacher, who's Eastwood, of course, who arrived as a result of a prayer from Megan, in which she quoted Psalm 23. Preacher's comment after beating one of the villains is, "Well, the Lord certainly does work in mysterious ways." After Coy offers to let him establish a lucrative ministry of his own, it's La Hood that offers him to have his own parish, his own church, and he turns him down and he says, "You can't serve God and Mammon both," Mammon being money. According to Robert Jevitt, the film's dialogue parallels Paul's the Apostle's teaching on divine retribution. So in Pale Rider, the biblical element is much more pronounced. And there's really a lot of Christian people talked, have spoken and written about Pale Rider. Another one says, although the mysterious stranger eventually reveals himself to be a gunslinger, his presence compels the main characters to come to terms with the meaning of love, justice, community, and the fight against evil. In this sense, his mission in La Hood is very moral indeed. He is a man of God who has come to spur others to defend their values and stand up for them. So what happens? The problem that this time you've got, as far as the main, it's really like a, it is like a sort of inversion of High Plains Drifter. So this time you've got the local businessman. He doesn't have the rights to the where the panhandlers are. He doesn't own that land, but he wants it. He doesn't have the deeds. If he did, he would have just used the law. So what he's got to do is basically make their lives a misery with all of these goons, and then eventually they're like the corrupt marshals. And Eastwood arrives to kind of set things straight. But the problem is that people aren't corrupt and like scummy like they are in High Plains Drifter. They're just meek. You know, the meek shall inherit the earth and all of that. And there's a key scene, I think, when they're bashing away at a big boulder which is blocking the creek, and Eastwood takes a sledgehammer to it, and then Hal goes along and helps him out. And then Hugh, like Jaws from James Bond, comes as a super-sized goon to scare them, to scare off Eastwood. And Eastwood takes the sledgehammer and just smashes it straight into his balls. I mean, it just looks so painful. I mean, Richard Keel, who plays Jaws, like, and appeared here, like, his career was just like to be a massive goon who got beaten up by either Clint Eastwood or Roger Moore. That was his career. But eventually, like, what happens, and I think why it's such a key scene, is that the men, once Eastwood has stood up to this monster, all of the men have respect for him, and then they all get their pickaxes and their sledgehammers, and they all start kind of working away on the boulder. So what you've got is the arrival of like an alpha male, the preacher, like a higher, stronger man, and then they all begin to rally behind him. And this is what drives La Hood nuts, because he had them where their spirit was being broken. And now the preacher comes along, and he even says as well, like, you know, these people, like a preacher's worse. Having a preacher arrive is worse than a good gunslinger, because he'll give them hope. And that's what happens.
One interesting dynamic is between the preacher versus La Hood, the mining industrials tycoon, the guy who wants to take over their town.
La Hood.
So, the contrast that I thought of was it's the aristocrat versus the oligarch. So an aristocrat is someone in a position of power who's motivated by idealism. They're rooted and they have an affinity for the land, which they have power over. Whereas the oligarch is somebody in a position of power motivated by material gain. So they have no affinity for the land. They have no higher ideals. It's really just what's the most profitable and what's the most beneficial for them. And that's what they'll rule in favor of. So the preacher kind of becomes like the de facto leader of the small mining village in the mountains, the same way that the stranger became the dictator of Lago in the other movie. But, you know, he actually has like a deep affinity for the people. He actually wants what's best for this this town. Now, he's not from the town, but he actually does see inherent value in the way that these people's way of life. Like there's a good scene where I think it's Barrett who says it, the main guy from the town, that he says, well, we all have family members buried here. We're not going to take, because they try to buy them off. They try to offer them money to vacate their town, but it's something that is really important to them. And I'll get onto that a bit later with when I had a bit written about him too. But with La Hood, he doesn't see any of that idealism really. He's just there because he wants a profit. He sees this small, like little community as not as something of inherent value, but just something that's blocking the way from his next trip to the bank. And I think that's what kind of distinguishes virtuous elites versus evil elites throughout history and today as well. You know, it goes all the way back to Aristotle, where he talks about aristocracy versus oligarchy, you know, one being virtuous, one being corrupt. And you see that playing out here as well.
Yeah, I like playing. I love High Plains. It's such. I mean, I know people. Somebody in the chat said it's like Little House on the Prairie compared to High Plains Drifter. But High Plains Drifter is it's like High Noon meets like Night of the Living Dead. It's so grim. Like it leaves such a bad taste in my mouth. But Pale Rider are just, the scenery's lovely, and the people are virtuous and good. And this is something that I don't know, I feel more comfortable with it. I mean, the main characters that we didn't touch on are, you've got Hal and then this woman, and the setup's weird. And this, I've got a bit of a hard time with a few things of this, which I don't really get. So the woman, the hard-faced woman, is called Carrie Snodgrass, and she looks like she's like 40, but she wasn't. Like, and she's got like a 14-year-old daughter called Megan, and they are being provided for by like a man called Hal, who just seems like a real cook to me. Like, he's this whimpering, weak kind of man, and he's like providing for a single woman with a teenage daughter. And I think the story behind that was that it was his friend, and he died, and now Hal like wants to take it all on, but she refuses to marry him until he completes his story arc of becoming like sort of braver and more noble, because of he's like going to follow Clint Eastwood's The Preacher's lead, and I just think that's a weird setup, because if like she in that the reality of that situation, she wouldn't have a leg to stand on. If she's living in his house with her daughter, she doesn't work, she's got no income, she's got no way to provide for her daughter, and she refuses to marry the man that's putting a roof over her head. Like, in reality, in the old West, she would have just accepted his proposal straight away, because she'd be out just dying on the side of the mountains. So I don't get that. And another thing which is more controversial is that Clint Eastwood sleeps with her as well, just because, hey, yeah, it's Clint Eastwood. And so Hal just gets cooked from all sides on this. I just find that element of the movies like quite weird. And then, of course, there's a famous thing in it where so Eastwood, he settles in with that family, if you can call it that. And then he takes his shirt off, and you see that he's got 5 bullet holes in his back, like 5 scars where he's obviously been shot. But it's never explained exactly what happened to him. But La Hood, once things, you know, tensions escalate, and then La Hood brings in, what is the marshal called?
Stockburn.
And he's a genuinely great, imposing character. I mean, he looks like he's dying. He looks like there was a similar character in one of the Poltergeist movies where you've got this kind of look to some of these old character actors. Like, his face looks like a volcano. It's so craggy, and he's got like a little pencil mustache. He just looks great. And he gets a description of the preacher, and it rings a bell with him. And La Hood looks at him, and he says, like, it's great, I think. And La Hood says that you act as if you recognize this man. And he says he's got these weird eyes that look straight through you. And then Stockburn says it does ring a bell, but it can't be true because that man's dead. And it's as if like he shot him. And then I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but yeah, they do sort of recognize each other, but it isn't explained in the way that it is with High Plains Drifter.
Yeah, so it's implied that Stockburn had killed Clint Eastwood when he was alive, and he's a spirit kind of coming back from the dead. But then again, like, it's not simply just a revenge story. It's also he also wants to bring fortunes with him. But yeah, I really like the character too. Also, I got to say that he has probably one of the coolest names ever, Stockburn. Like, that's just like that name is just like dripping testosterone, I have to say.
Did you notice that they're wearing the same kind of jackets that
they, yeah, like the duster coats?
The duster coats that they wore on Once Upon a Time in the West, which we've also, yes, spoke about on an earlier episode, if you want to go and check that out. Yeah, they look almost like the same people that turn up at the train station in Once Upon a Time in the West.
Yeah, so you can, even though Eastwood wasn't in it, but I know that, you know, he worked with Leone, so definitely there was a connection between the two. And the other thing that's interesting is that about this one is that this was made after the Western genre already had its heyday. So the Wild West movies were big in the 50s and 60s mostly, even earlier than that, when John Wayne was the big star. And they kind of started to die off in the 70s and 80s. So, you know, something like High Plains would have been one of the later Western movies, whereas in the 70s and 80s, you think a lot more about things like sci-fi, things like Star Wars or RoboCop or Terminator, stuff like that. Eastwood actually kind of brought back the Western genre and wanted to see if, you know, he could bring this genre back, kind of back to life with this movie, and then kind of put this new twist on it, and even kind of integrate some like biblical themes too. I also thought of, you know, someone that is more versed on theology than me might have some objections, but I kind of thought that the stranger in High Plains was kind of like the God of the Old Testament, whereas the preacher in Pale Rider is more like the God of the New Testament. So you read in the Old Testament about like cities being destroyed and God like punishing people for their sin and for turning away from him. But then in the New Testament, it's about like the riches that he brings to you, about him bringing salvation to earth. So there's an interesting dynamic there too.
Yeah, there's an interesting because I like to do a bit of background research on this, and I sent you the article, and it was the 1985 Chicago Tribune Review, and I just thought it was such a thoughtful, well written piece for a newspaper. I mean, just as an aside, remember when like newspaper articles were actually interesting? Remember when it wasn't just dumb, stupid, insulting propaganda? When somebody who would write a review of a movie would actually understand all of these biblical themes, and they'd have like a more nuanced and philosophical take. So by the time you finish reading an article, if you want to check out the Chicago Tribune's article on Pale Rider, it's one of those ones where once you've finished reading the article, you feel as if you've learned something. You feel more intelligent. And I read it and I thought, isn't it like, why the newspapers today are just absolute dog crap? It's just rubbish. But anyway, so back in the interesting quote is from this article. The writer said, the NPR writer, the enemy is the devil himself. The mechanized mining methods of the tycoon's company look to Megan and the young girl like hell, she says. And even the villainous lawman's name, Stockburn, conjures up flames. And an interesting thing is that on the desecration of the landscape, as you pointed out, La Hood is using like real high-powered hoses, water pressure, and he's just blasting the mountainside away like with no regard for the nature or anything. It is just a desecration, a rape of the land. And what's interesting is that when Megan, the young girl, goes to she's actually goes and she's watching them just desecrate the land, and then the men who are doing it, La Hood's goons, she comes very close to getting gang raped. But Eastwood turns up and shoots Chris Penn through the hand and rescues her. But it's what a clever little thing there, where you've got like the symbolic rape of the land and then like this innocent girl as well. So they really are in demonic, the La Hood and his thugs.
Yeah, I think though that the kind of the difference is that this one actually has that element of good there. So there's the element of evil, but then there also is the good in contrast to that. That being the villagers in the mountain. And the other thing I thought of was that kind of and we got into this with the Once Upon a Time in the West review, the contrast between the settler and the industrialist or the merchant, however you want to call him. So. When you went back, if you look at the American West, it would have been the people that would have ventured out there originally, and you can use all of America as this for an example. They were settlers, so they were people who were generally more religious. They were going off in search of like a better life, and there had to have been some kind of ambition on their part that was beyond just, you know, the material. Because if you're somebody just going off into you know, whether it's somebody getting on the Mayflower and going off to Plymouth Rock 400 years ago, or, you know, someone going off to these empty plains or, you know, to these mountains or something like that about 150 years ago. You're not going to be as well off as you would have been if you stayed in one of the major cities of the time. But you have to kind of take that. It's kind of like taking that first step, which is a really big challenge. But then what comes after that is the industrialists. So somebody like La Hood, now that there is the settlers, so the settlers are now in the canyon, the West is now being settled, and now he comes along and sees the situation, and now he wants to exploit it for money. So you even see that same contrast where the guys who are living in the village in the mountain, they have this kind of affinity for the land. They want to live there, not necessarily for money, but because they think that's where they have a good life. That's where they want to build their community. They have their ancestors buried there. Whereas somebody like La Hood, he kind of is bringing modernity with him. He's bringing the industrialization, bringing capitalism along. That was the corruption and the destruction of that traditional way of life of the town and the little village in the mountains by, you know, you just see the image of them like blowing holes into the side of the mountain. So that's another common theme that you see emerge often, is that you'll have the settlers, the ones with the ambition going off and creating something new. Then who follows that is the people who don't have that same drive, but the ones who want to exploit it for money, who don't have the same idealism.
Yeah, it's well said, because if you look at the Lago in High Plains Drifter, what binds the people together is evil. It is a crime. That's their common thing. That's what binds them together. And let's say the villagers, if you could even call it a village, the people in the mountain, the miners on Pale Rider, what the lesson they learn, because over the course of it, is that they belong together. They have their own community, and they begin to understand that it isn't actually material. It isn't actually about the gold. And they have this, they actually discuss this for quite a bit. And what the preacher, what Eastwood makes them understand, is that there's a sense of themselves. There's a sense that they belong together. They've got a history there, and they belong on the land. And it isn't just about the gold. It isn't just about striking it rich. And in fact, the one of the most brutal scenes is when one of the villagers, I forgot his name now, but like an old fella, he does strike it rich, and he goes into town and boasts, like stupidly. He gets drunk, and he's got this huge lump of gold. And he's insulting La Hood, and that's when Stockburn and all of his, deputies come out and make him dance. And then eventually he's drunk and he tries to draw his weapon, and they just absolutely riddle him with bullets. And then Stockburn like shoots him just square in the forehead, and it's as if like he kind of got carried away, and he in a way became almost like La Hood and was punished for it. And so it's when the village, the people, decide that they've got each other, and they've got like they're good people, and they just want a home. They come to that realization. It's at exactly at that moment that Eastwood switches from preacher to gunslinger, because it's as if he's saying, now you've understood. Now, like the fella in the article said, now you've earned the right to be protected. You've found your way to goodness and truth and beauty, and therefore the priest's collar gets put away and the guns come out, and it's a great moment.
There's something that we haven't mentioned yet, that there was a deal between that the preacher had struck with La Hood. So he said he went into his office and said to them, "Well, why don't you pay them to leave?" And then La Hood offered, "Well, I'll pay $100 per person." And Eastwood says, "Well, it has to be $1,000. Then La Hood says, "Oh, that's crazy. 200 is the highest I can do." But eventually Eastwood gets him up to $1,000 per person, which I imagine in those days would have been like a ton of money, to say the least, certainly more than any of them would have had in that little village. And then Eastwood comes back with that proposal, and they're like seriously considering. And I kind of think that the minute that Hal like ceases to be a cuck, so the guy who was living with the main character, the guy who's living with the other woman who he's not married to and her daughter, the second that he stops to cease to be a cuck is when he when they're sitting around the fire discussing it, and he says that no, we're not going to accept this offer. You know, this is our town. Our ancestors came here, and we're going to stay here. You know, no matter what. I think that that's kind of when he actually grows a pair of balls.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth pointing out as well that La Hood owns almost everything except the hardware shop. And that there's another holdout in the hardware shop. They are the ones that are giving the miners credit. But that's reaching its limit. Because basically, it is like a mini version of what's going on in the real world, where you've got like the corporations are just buying up everything and shifting people off the land, you know, so they can have all these hard assets. And I don't know, is that what's going to happen to us? Are we going to be like those? Are we going to be like those miners? It's nice because it's those timeless themes, and I think. The Pale Rider, especially but the High Plains stick out, but especially Pale Rider, is that you get this kind of mythic, supernatural element woven into the West, which I think is accurate as well, because if you look at the John Wayne Westerns, you know, the spaghetti Westerns, they don't really have any kind of religious element to them, even though like the average town folk in a John Wayne movie, they will be like good, simple, God-fearing people. But I think what's great about Pale Rider is that he really like brings that out, you know, because the people of that era and in that place, they would have been like really deeply religious.
Yeah, that's one thing that's often forgotten about. That's often forgotten about, like the early settlers. Like you can even look at, like I mentioned earlier, the Mayflower. Like America started entirely based on people being like so deeply religious that they wanted to leave England just to set up their own like religious Puritan society. That's how America became that's how America became a country. You know, it is kind of it is like deeply ironic that today America is like the capital of Globo Homo. It's the greatest. It's the pusher of all of the things that are evil in the world, not to put it all at their feet, but it certainly has been the biggest player at that over the last couple of decades. But, you know, it actually did start as a deeply religious society. And, you know, I think that you use that kind of that theme of it, of that, like the corruption over time. So like I mentioned earlier, the deeply religious settlers, they set up their own traditional society on a land, and then money and power and corruption comes along and then exploits it. And I think that's kind of what you can see happening today.
Yeah, I mean, the sad thing is in reality, the La Hoods of the world won. That's the kind of, I mean, it's very much downplayed in this. I mean, in this one, the God-fearing, hard-working people come out on top with the help of, like, with a divine intervention in the guise of Clint Eastwood. But you'll see the themes in the Westerns, which we touched on at length in Once Upon a Time in the West, that it is this kind of sadness. It is this, the fences are going up and the railroads are arriving and all of this kind of thing. And that's probably why Pale Rider leaves you with a kind of nice feeling, because good comes out on top. But in so many of the other ones, another one is Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, which we can do sometime as well. I did my own video on it. It was an earlier video. And on that one, it is like Billy the Kid is it's like he's running out of places to run to. And he keeps coming. He wants to just roam free across the land. But there's more fences going up and more directions about where he can and can't go. And Pat Garrett is like sided with the machine because he sees the writing on the wall, and he is like Billy's best friend, but like he sees that in long term Billy's way of life is over, and so he sides with, you know, with the corporations, with the system, and goes out after Billy the Kid, but he knows in his soul that it's wrong that he's doing it. He knows that he's out to end his own world, and it's beautifully poetic. We'll have to do that one time as well.
Yeah, funny you mentioned that. Like the fences are going up everywhere, and you're just trying to find somewhere to run just so that you can get away from it, but you're running out of places. That actually kind of accurately describes my life right now.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like you're trying to not that we need to get into that agenda in particular, but you're trying to get away from the new fences that are being put up, the new medical surveillance tyranny that's being put up across the world. And we really are running out of places to go. Like, you might have think that this stuff might have just been the talk of like some libtard places like, I don't know, London or New York a year ago, but no, it's everywhere now. And you're just running out of places to run to. But I think they'll eventually, I guess the takeaway from a hype from Pale Rider would be that you eventually have to take that stand somewhere, wherever that may be. You have to take that stand because the stock, the La Hoods of the world, the ones today, they're not quite as, they might not be quite as old West and as masculine and as straight white male as La Hood was in the movie. But, the bug man or the soy boy or whatever, who's trying to get you to plug into this new system today, he's not going to leave you alone the same way that you won't be, that the village and Pale Rider are not going to be left alone in their own village in the mountain. They kind of have to take a stand somewhere.
I mean, it's worth pointing out just the similarity as well. At the beginning of Pale Rider, it's a little touch that I picked up watching it again for this. I've seen it so many times, but it's a really nice little touch where, so in High Plains Drifter, he comes out of the desert, out of the mirage, and it's as if he just appears. That isn't really what happens on Pale Rider, but he comes down the mountain. It's as if he's coming down from heaven, and then at the end of it, you see that he actually goes back up. It's another little thing, as if he's like, as if he's like this Jesus kind of figure. I mean, imagine it's just on a lighter note. Like, imagine being Clint Eastwood. He casts himself in these roles. Like, imagine the. I think that's why he beds all the women, which is out of character. Like the idea that he bedded that hard faced Carrie Snodgrass, who he knew Hal was like desperate to marry, and yet there's still that scene where she's like, even the daughter, even the 14-year-old daughter tries it on with him, but he knocks her back. So he does the mother instead, and you think, like, imagine being Clint Eastwood and yeah, I think I'll do that. I think I'll have that in the script. And I'd more marshals on for me to gun. And then I'm going to be like this kind of God, Jesus, savior figure. And I'm going to teach all these cooks and cowards how to stand on their own two feet. Like, this is my movie, and this is what I'm going to do with the movie. I mean, what a lad. What a bloke. I'm going to be this womanizing God figure who comes back from the dead, teaches all these cowards how to stand on their feet. I'm going to shoot all the bad guys, and then I'm going to go back up the mountain into heaven at the end of it with me mystical five bullet holes in me back. That's my movie, bucko. That's who I am, arsehole.
But he'll have the scene in there where he refuses the 14-year-old girl to show that he's also modest.
there's limits. They didn't even have to put that bit in. Like, it's so weird because he was about 60 when he did Pale Rider, and he has to make excuses. Like, even like the 14-15-year-old girls like begging him for sex and stuff. I mean, come on, for Christ's sake.
That scene was not the most comfortable scene, to be honest.
So I've got a few super chats come in, so I think I'm going to do a quick refresh and we'll see what's come in here. So first of all, thank you very much. I've got one. I saw one from Dawn Browning. Blinking head, I caught one live. It's nice to see Dawn still around there. Thank you very much, Dawn. 20 Australian, isn't it? $4.99 from Bolero. Here's a small reward for the virtuous men on this stream. Well, we do our best. Thank you very much. Another Australian $20 from Pete. Thank you very much. Pardon me, fellas, for bringing up the oligarchy. Oh, no, how am I going to I don't know how to open all of that up from I'm not used to getting super chats. I remember seeing it. He was it was along the lines of saying, like, other oligarchs in the real world today, is that not a new aristocracy? And I think that was getting back to your question.
Okay.
I'll just say quickly,
I found the chat. I can read it out in full.
All right.
It says, pardon me, fellas, for interrupting, but wouldn't the oligarchy basically be an extension of aristocracy? Due to how both have some elements of most glories only being given to certain individuals having certain ties. So what he's saying is that both are giving like a certain amount of glories to certain people who have certain ties. And wouldn't that kind of be the same? Would you like me to tackle that one first, or would you like to go for it?
I'll just say quickly, I think the difference is that the oligarchs are just purely godless materialists. And a genuine aristocracy is completely different.
Yeah, that was pretty much my take too. It's that if you look at somebody like Bill Gates or Klaus Schwab or Justin Trudeau today, or then, you know, the tribe or someone like that, they're rootless. They're just materialists. Maybe not so much with the tribe. They actually have ethnic interests. But then someone like Gates, you know, his dream of the world is somewhere where, you know, everybody is like walking around with some little like digital ID so that he can charge them a subscription service based on that. I mean, there's just like no idealism at all. It's a pretty big contrast between that and, say, you know, someone like Louis the 14th. And, you know, today someone like Mark Zuckerberg or Bill Gates, they're probably more powerful than Louis the 14th. But when you just look at them in comparison, like just look at Louis versus Mark Zuckerberg with his, like, you know, nerdy blue sweater or something in his metaverse with his like weird glasses on, or riding on that like hoverboard on the water. I mean, the difference is that one of them actually is religious. One of them actually has some ideals and actually believes in civilization, whereas the other one is really just interested in, like, you know, how can I get people to look at more advertisements? How can I get people stuck into this like subscription model where they're paying me every month? I think that ultimately it is really spiritual. So both are given benefits based on being part of a certain group. But I think, though, the nature of that matters a lot more than the fact that there's a small group that's in power.
So somebody in the chat says, does Eastwood wear a poncho in every Western? No, he doesn't. He you can split it up. The Dollars ones, he wears the poncho, and then a couple of the earlier ones as well. I think stuff like Two Mules for Sister Sarah. That's when you tend to see the poncho. And then when he goes into his more mature gray bearded phase, like Pale Rider, Unforgiven, High Plains, then you get like this long kind of trench coat thing that he wears, this duster thing that he wears. So no, there was another one that I wanted to look at as well, about Carrie Snodgrass. Somebody says that was Neil Young's first wife. Now, so this is like the female lead in Pale Rider. And I mentioned earlier, like, she had this hard face, and she really does. And I was out before, and I was thinking, just on that character of Carrie Snodgrass, like, she still isn't even that old, but she looks old in 1985 because she's just got that look. And she's perfectly cast because, you know, if you imagine a woman, like a woman, a 40-year-old woman who lives in like a shack, like a mining shack in the 1860s or whatever, like she wouldn't look that great. You know what I mean? She's going to look, and I imagine the Carrie Snodgrass, she looks like she's like from a Scottish fishing village in like the 1910s or something like that. Just got this really hard, leathery look to her face. So it's well cast, but bah. I mean, Clint goes there, like, of course he does.
Yeah, they didn't have YouTube makeup tutorials back then, or, you know, the supermarkets to go, or the hair products. So, you know, it must have been, you know, probably more reflective of how an actual woman would have looked like back then, maybe.
Yeah, it will be. I've got a couple of coffees as well, so... Thanks for all you do for our people, Morgoth, your ability to take the thoughts I've had and observations I've made since 9/11 and put these thoughts and words the common man can understand is unparalleled. Well, thank you very much. That's great to hear. Because somebody else, I enjoyed your streams for a while. He's got fired from work for no needlecraft. Thank God for hex stakes. I don't know what that is. Let's hope this BS is crumbling. It looks like it, but I don't want to get too sidetracked on all of that on me classic movie streams, but I'm going to do a video taking a look at where we are this week. But, I mean, I suppose it's shit like what's happened to you there, mate. I don't know what to say, but I suppose you're still free of it. Like, there's another one coming just there quickly from Grief for £10. Thank you very much. Just pressing F for Hal. Cooked within an inch of his life. Thanks for the laughs, fellas. Great streams. Yeah, I mean, I don't. Why? So, could Hal have been done any differently? Do you think? Like, what? How? I mean, one of the things that if you like, it goes back to Clint Eastwood and how much of a Chad he is. Like, he's got him, and then say, La Hood is like a slimy slug, which is perfectly in keeping with what he is. And then you've got Stockburn, and Stockburn's a real hard Chad as well. It's just that he's evil. And I think what's happened with the Hal character, because it's like, this is a danger when you are like in such control as Eastwood is of his movies, is that you don't want to have another like male around who's in any way going to be like sort of treading on your toes and like out alphaing you. But I just think he went a little bit too far with the character of Hal. Like, he really is. I mean, just look at it in High Plains Drifter. You've got Hal in Pale Rider, like the cook, the whimpering cook who has to get taught by Eastwood like how to be a man. That's like the second male lead. And then in High Plains Drifter, you've got a midget. So it's just like he doesn't want. It's just like there'll be no competition at all for Clint.
I mean, I maybe it would have been a bit less painful if for Hal if they didn't have the scene where Eastwood beds his woman. But yeah, I mean, you can definitely see where Eastwood is. He doesn't want any of the competition. So yeah.
So Pale Rider was the second last Western that Eastwood did, and then it was followed by Unforgiven. Which I don't know. I don't know if we have you seen Unforgiven?
Because
we're running way ahead of schedule. And the thing with Eastwood's, most of Eastwood's westerns, which is interesting, is they in Unforgiven, he's all of them are like a kind of deconstruction of the Western myth, I would say, except for Pale Rider. I think Pale Rider is deeply conservative. And when if you go back to John Wayne's criticisms of the way, because John Wayne criticized Once Upon a Time in the West, and even like we were saying, it Once Upon a Time in the West was like the first postmodernist Western, and the same can be said for High Plains Drifter, because it's as if they have placed these strategic charges on like the Western myth. So instead of the people being God-fearing, you know, conservative, hardworking types, they're scumbags and they're liars. And in Unforgiven, it's more focused on the myth of the gunslinger himself. So in it, Eastwood is getting on. I mean, he's in his 60s then. And he goes back to, for no other reason than he's skint, but he's been out of commission for a long time and he's a pig farmer. And it kind of debunks a lot of the tropes to it. So he's not a very good shot anymore. And then there's somebody else goes along with him, this young kid, and he's blind. And Gene Hackman's in it and Richard Harris. And there's this real attempt to kind of deflate and debunk the myth of the gunslinger. There's one scene where somebody gets shot. So in Eastwood's movies, it's all clean kills. And in Unforgiven, though, there's somebody gets shot in the stomach, and he's like, he's in a canyon, and he's a young lad, and you can hear him like screaming on, and it takes like an hour for him to slowly, like painfully die. And it's as if the message of it is like this is the reality of it. All of the good, the bad, and the ugly, and all of that, like that's kind of, it's like crap. Because the reality, the realism of it is that when you get shot, you're gonna like roll around and cry out in pain for an hour or so and slowly bleed to death.
Let's just clarify that. We mean that, like, you know, people being shot and falling over dead, stone cold. That's crap. Not The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That's a great movie.
Oh, no. It's that's what they're trying to say, is that in his younger years, it's like Eastwood's trying to come to terms with some of the blood splattered movies that he made in his younger years. But still, from the John Wayne perspective, it doesn't, you know, it's like weird how Eastwood kept the Western going by commenting on the Western. The one that stands out, which he doesn't do that, is Pale Rider, which is why I think it's so special. And it's almost like a love letter back to John Wayne, as if to say, you know, I think it was 13 years or so later after High Plains.
Yeah, John Wayne was dead by then.
Yeah, John Wayne was dead by then. And I think it was Eastwood kind of saying, John Wayne was right. If your take on your, like, the Western myth, if it is like purely nihilist and deconstruction and all of this, then, like, yeah, you are going to end up with nothing. Like, you never end up with anything at the end of postmodernism. And so I think The Pale Rider is almost like a love letter to John Wayne. Because John Wayne could have been in that situation. If John Wayne could have played any of Eastwood's roles, it would be Pale Rider or the character in Unforgiven. He actually kind of did that in The Shootist, which was John Wayne's last ever movie, and that he won an Oscar for.
Yeah, because when they deconstructed the West, people like Leone and then Eastwood continued the tradition. When you look at the John Wayne movie, it's always like the sheriff is the good guy. He's the all-American hero. The gunslinger comes to town. Their sheriff takes him out and saves the good town folk. When they deconstructed that, they didn't take out the violence. So it was still the movies were still full of shooting and killing and stuff like that. All the violence. But they kind of made it that nihilistic, like you mentioned. So when you think of Eastwood in the Dollar series, he's the man with no name. He's not really heroic. He's just kind of some drifter out there going, who's just out for himself, you know, being a badass, kind of like in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He's a decent fellow, but really ultimately at the end, he just gets a bunch of gold for himself and makes himself rich. Same with Once Upon a Time in the West, like the three main characters in that movie, none of them are really heroes. One of them is just motivated by revenge against another gunslinger. And the other one is a bandit himself who just kind of has a bit of a good heart in him. But they kept all the violence of those old ones. So then when Eastwood kind of reconstructs the West in what's it called? Pale Rider, he kind of wants to bring back the goodness that was in the John Wayne movies. I haven't seen Unforgiven, but I'll definitely put that one on my list because, it is interesting because when people think of the Old West and they think of like gunfights and stuff like that, it wasn't actually like that. Like one statistic I've heard is that you are today far more likely to be shot and killed in any given American city, namely the ones with a certain youth population. You're far more likely to be shot and killed in Baltimore or Chicago or Detroit today than someone living in a town in the Old West was. So it was not like what you see in Hollywood where you get shot in the face for looking at someone the wrong way. It is a lot, really a Hollywood creation. And it is interesting when somebody takes that on with a more realistic, from a more realistic lens, because, you know, someone being shot back in the Old West, they didn't really have very good antibiotics back then. They didn't really have good, I don't think they had very much morphine or something like that. Like imagine, having your leg amputated when you're out in the plains and, somewhere in the Old West when the only doctor for, the only doctor for 1,000 miles is also the town barber. He's only the surgeon because he's good with a knife.
I mean, the thing with the John Wayne as well, which is another contrast with the Clint Eastwood, is that, like, famously, Clint Eastwood is the man with no name. So nobody knows, like, what in almost none of them. I mean, the outlaw Josie Wales, he has a background, which is wiped out at the start of the movie. And he has something of a background in Unforgiven. But by and large, in all of his Westerns, he is the man with no name. He's this mysterious character who comes into the town. John Wayne is completely different. In John Wayne Westerns, in all of them, you know exactly who he is, and he has roots wherever he is. Because John Wayne did an absolute ton of Westerns, and people will think of like True Grit, but even in True Grit, you know his real name. He'll talk about the woman, his wife who hated him and kicked him out, and you see him like he's like this kind of, you know, he's like an eye patch. He's like a fat slob, and he lives in the back of this like Chinese restaurant thing on a little cot. And most of the time in the big John Wayne Westerns, he is like the patriarch of the town. He's a businessman or like somebody who everybody knows and everybody looks up to. And so when the danger arrives, the character of the people is different. The character of the people is usually like wholesome and good, but he'll have to round up and get people into shape. So you'll come across people like Dean Martin will be like a top gun. He was once like a top gunslinger, but now he's a drunk because some dance girl broke his heart. There's this other fella that always pops up in John Wayne movies. I don't know his name, but like he's absolutely ancient, and he's like this half-wit old bloke, and he looks gormless. And he'll kind of come along for the ride with a shotgun. There's usually like a kind of young guy who's too aggressive and too, you know, and he has to be slapped down a little bit. So it's always that John Wayne is he's not alone in the way Eastwood is. He's always got this like John Wayne entourage of like weird oddball characters. But what it's about, of course, is community, because fundamentally it's a different outlook. It's a different way of looking at things. And you can see why he gets incensed at this, like the cynicism of say the spaghetti westerns and whatnot.
Yeah, and I'd say that Pale Rider is probably the first one where Eastwood actually even has any kind of human connection at all, because all the movies he's in, he's just kind of this loner who shows up and then leaves at the end and never really makes any human connection. So that definitely is a different role for Eastwood. It's also worth noting that John Wayne even played. Have you seen the Alamo, the 1960 version?
Yeah, long ago.
Yeah, that might be a good one for a future stream. But yeah, John Wayne played Davy Crockett in that one. So you know, he played an actual American hero. So he really is kind of always being the all American hero, whereas in Eastwood's Western guy is always the obscure stranger who really doesn't have any.
The anti-hero is. Even in True Grit, like John Wayne has that young woman like badgering him or and insulting him all the way along, you know. So he's very much of the people, and he is the patriarch. He is the big daddy who's going to take out the trash. But what it makes that you also like the people. You know that some of the characters just are never going to die. But I suppose the one that's different is the Searchers, where he, in the Searchers, he is more of a loner. He is, but that's, I mean, the Searchers is a whole other stream. I don't want to, you know, I've opened up a can of worms there. But yeah, there's a lot going on with the Searchers. But I think that's a wrap. I'm going to be quite active this week. I've got Morgcast, which I've done and recorded and got, and I'm going to put that up on Odyssey tomorrow. I've had a conversation with Todd Lewis, so we'll get into some of the spicier things about the world at the moment. Todd's very, very well read, got some interesting takes, and then I think further on in the week I'm going to be doing a sort of where are we now with the Koof narrative, but that'll be on Odyssey as well, I think. So I'm a busy boy at the moment. So what we're doing next time then, Endeavor?
I haven't decided yet, but I have a list of a few which I'll bounce off of you. So we'll announce that once we've come to that conclusion.
All right. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. I hope you had a nice cozy Sunday. We'll be back again. I really do love these streams. I find them so comfy. So See you next time, lads and lasses. Take care.